Today is Memorial Day, May 30th, 2011. My name is Ann Smith, and I'm from the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program at the University of Florida. And I am here with Arnold van der Poorten, who is being interviewed for the collection on World War II as one of the German-born interviewees. And he has written two books. Is that right, Arnold?
That's right.
And I have one of them here that I wanted to start out with because it seems like it's a good introduction. May I?
Oh, certainly.
This says, this is the preface of your book called The Nine Lives of Arnold. And it says, where the mist is cool, in the fog crows caw, where traditions rule, but the weather is raw. When men were at war and women forlorn, just then and there, fate had me born. Did you like the background of the birds from the clock? It adds atmosphere, okay. Don't you think? And so you were born. All right, let's start there, since I don't think we can go beyond that.
No.
Now tell me, where were you born?
In Hamburg City. As a matter of fact, at number 15... Eppendorfer Street, during the war, and my father at that time was at a military hospital because it was World War I, and he was assigned to that hospital. He was a medical doctor, and my mother had three children already. It was the beginning of starvation winter, so everybody was hungry, and my mother lost 5 kilograms, that's 11 pounds, while she was carrying me.
Tell me what year this was, Arnold.
That was 1917.
Okay.
November 30th, 1917. So when I was born, I was an undersized, shriveled-up baby, and my sister insisted that I was the ugliest baby she had ever seen.
How much older was she?
She's 9.5 years my senior. So
you started out kind of fighting for your life.
Yes, and that's
from the very beginning.
Yes, and that's how my life went. It was the time when the war was ending.
World War One.
There was no coal to keep the apartment warm. Food was very strictly rationed, and often even that rationed food couldn't be supplied. And such things as leather were not available for civilians, so my brother said that during that time he went to school with the soles of his shoes having such big holes that it was practically naked, walking in the snow with naked soles. So it was a pretty awful time. But then,
what was your earliest memory yourself that you weren't told but that you remember as a little boy?
Well, the first things I remember was that there was inflation and that there was revolution. During the revolution, we had two servants who were glad that they had a shelter and got pocket money. And one of them organized a burglary in our house where they stole all the fur coats of my parents. My father wore fur coat. Men wore their furs inside the coat.
Mm-hmm.
And they had guests, and they came in fur coats. And so the servant organized this theft, and one of the men saw me and made me come, and he put his hands around my neck, and the servant got very excited and gave him signal not to kill me. And I promised the servant that I wouldn't tell.
How old were you?
I was, well, it was revolution time, maybe 3.
Uh-huh.
And
so you saw them stealing the coats?
I remember that very well. And another thing I remember, that my father, my grandfather, and my uncle came because I had a large abscess on my left jaw, and my grandfather wanted to cut into the abscess on the left side, and my uncle would give the anesthesia, the anesthetic.
And they were medical doctors too?
Yeah, all three were medical doctors. My father, my uncle was a pioneer in anesthetics.
Uh-huh.
And my father said, no, cut in the middle of the chin and draw the pus from underneath the skin. So he saved me from having a very ugly scar on my left jaw. And the scar in the middle of my chin looks like a dimple.
So you could keep your good looks.
Yeah, so I remember my mother sitting beside me in my next to my bed, and I told her, don't bring that man back.
I don't want to go through that again.
And then the next thing I remember as a little child was my sister and I were running, and my sister told me to hurry up because the streetcar fares will go up at 12, and we had to go somewhere on the streetcar, and she wouldn't have enough money to pay for the fare.
Uh-huh.
So we got on the streetcar, but it was little after 12, and the conductor told us to get off. That was very during the big inflation.
Uh-huh.
And then I remember that we had good times. My mother would take us shopping downtown in a horse-drawn taxi, and we would, as a treat, go to a swanky restaurant and have beautiful torts, and there was an orchestra, maybe a three-piece string orchestra, and play classical music, and then we would go home, sometimes walk at home, sometimes take a taxi. But when the motor car taxis came, my mother didn't trust them, so they didn't trust that a driver could be as good as a horse. So
nobody likes change.
So we had to walk home. But it was a beautiful walk from downtown Hamburg past the Alster Ufer, which was a street, means banks of the Alster. Alster is a big lake in Hamburg city, and they have regattas there and sailboats, and it's very pretty there.
Uh-huh.
And all along between the street and the lake, there are rose gardens for miles. So we would walk along there. Those were my earliest memories.
And you stayed in Hamburg until what age?
When I was 15, I was 15 years and 2 months. Hitler was announced on the radio to be the Prime Minister of Germany.
What did your parents think about that?
Well, I knew the whole family was very strongly against Hitler. For one, my father came from a Jewish family, though he was an atheist and didn't practice any religion, and I was completely unfamiliar with Jewish faith, because my mother was a Lutheran and she insisted that I was baptized, and in school we had Lutheran religious education every mm-hmm. week, mm-hmm. and I had to take every Saturday afternoon for the last year courses in the Lutheran Catechism, and I was then confirmed when I was 15 in early 1933, as a matter of fact, Palm Sunday, mm-hmm. 1933. But no, it was, yes, it was 1933. I was 15 then.
And
Hitler had come to power earlier that year, in January 30th, 1933. Mm-hmm. It was announced over the radio that von Hindenburg, the president, a former war hero, mm-hmm. he was the commander-in-chief of the German forces, and then he succeeded Ebert, who was a socialist, and von Hindenburg had no choice but to appoint Hitler in a coalition government. It was the only government that would get a majority in the parliament. Hindenburg's party, the German Nationalist People's Party, and the Hitler's party, the Nationalist Socialist German Labour Party, merged. And that day, the Monday morning, when I went to school, we went to the assembly hall as usual. But as soon as we were there, the headmaster, Dr. Züge.
How do you spell his name?
Z U umlaut G E.
Okay.
Introduced Dr. Payne, P A Y N, as the new assistant headmaster for political affairs. And Dr. Payne then launched a vicious harangue against the French, the British, the Russians, the communists, and the Russians, of course, and Americans for what they had done to us during World War I. And on top of that, he also made a harangue against the Jews. And one of the things that really got me excited was that he threatened all teachers who had not found their way to Hitler yet would be eliminated. And when we went, and then he rolled the swastika flag off the lectern and screamed that we must sing our national anthem with an outstretched hand, the Nazi salute. Well, I certainly sang the national anthem, but I held my hand right straight to my side. And then he yelled that we must sing the Horst Wessel Lied, which was the Nazi anthem, and also with an outstretched hand, and I sat down. The teacher had a position where he could overlook the entire class. He stood by the stained glass windows of the assembly hall, And the class had two benches, so he could see right over those two benches. When I came into the classroom afterwards, we always walked in formation to our classroom, or in anywhere in the building we were, walked in formation. So he called on me and asked me why I didn't salute when the national anthem was sung, and why I sat down when the Horst Wessel Lied was sung. And I launched into a very emotional speech about the free speech in Hamburg was always guaranteed for centuries. And what Dr. Pine said was very much against the spirit of Hamburg. It was against the law. It was against the Treaty of Versailles. And what he said about the teachers being eliminated was downright criminal. And the class started to boo me. And Dr. Unbehauen, actually he was not a doctor, Studienrat Unbehauen, a sort of compared to an MS or MA, said that we have free speech in Hamburg, and if anybody wanted to contradict me, must do that after I sit down. So the class was absolutely quiet while I talked. And I talked to the end of the class when the bell rang and everybody left the classroom, and I was just in tears. Tears were streaming down my face. And as I sat there and trying to collect myself, three of the boys came into the classroom and shook my hands. And one of them had tears in his eyes. So I was the spokesman for the anti-Nazis in my class.
But it sounds like the majority of the class were pro.
Oh, yes. The Hitler movement was definitely a youth movement.
Yes.
The older people had no interest whatsoever in Hitler because they had seen World War I.
Sure.
They had gone through it. They had gone through starvation. And they didn't want war under any circumstances. And even though Hitler had made in the last election the slogans all over, painted all over the city and printed all over the city, vote for Hitler, vote for peace, most people didn't believe that part. And except for the youth, I don't think there were that many Nazis. Of course, our school was an upper school. There's a class difference. They had schools which were free and schools where the tuition was paid, and our school was one where tuition was paid. So we were all from more or less wealthy families.
Mm-hmm.
So for the youth, the Hitler movement was absolutely great. The pretty uniform and the singing together and hiking together, it was mm-hmm. great for them. And I had made a trip to Sylt with the 12 other boys of the class, and many of them were Hitler youth, some of them were scouts, and I was really behind as far as outdoor living is concerned, because it was a 3-day bicycle ride, and my bicycle was in terrible shape, but one of the Hitler youth and another boy, they fixed it up the best they knew how. I didn't know anything about mechanics at that time. And so and they distributed all my luggage among the other boys. So it was a very good class spirit in my class.
Mm-hmm.
And my being opposed to the Nazi movement did not disturb our class spirit at all.
Mm-hmm.
There was enough tolerance and freedom in their minds, being good Hamburgians.
Yeah.
that they accepted me fully. But in the fall, the teacher called in my father and told him not to send me back after the fall break for my own safety. And furthermore, I wouldn't be able to graduate because I didn't have the political maturity. I wasn't a Hitler Youth, in other words.
I'll be darned.
So,
what did your father think about that?
Well, he patted me on the back. He said I should always stand up for what I thought. And he sent me to night school, to private night school, to learn how to type and the elements of bookkeeping. But on October 14th, 1933, we were all told that Hitler was going to make a very important speech. And it was a Sunday morning, and my father and I were glued to the radio. Television, of course, was not invented in those days.
Sure.
And Hitler made a speech condemning the former Allies and the Jews, and especially the Treaty of Versailles. He said it wasn't worth the paper it was written on. Now, the Treaty of Versailles gave 13% of German territory to other countries.
Uh-huh.
And it broke up his native country, Austria, into many little fractions so that Austria itself was only the German-speaking part of Austria. Austria, before the war of 1914, was sort of a melting pot for the Balkans. And it was maybe the only European melting pot, and was good in that respect. But Hitler wanted it back. And that Hitler was an Austrian more than a national German could be seen. The Hitler Youth flag was red, white, red, which is the Austrian colors, with a swastika in it, whereas the Austrian flag was red, white, red with an eagle in it. Mm-hmm. The uniform of the stormtroopers looked very much like the Austrian army uniform of World War I. So there was, and the chief minister for the Hitler Youth was an Austrian, and many of the cabinet were Austrians.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Hitler got the majority in the Reichstag, the parliament, was by arresting all communists, were almost 20% of the members of the parliament, and let them disappear at what he called a Nacht und Nebel, a night and fog. They just disappeared, and if you asked for them, you were arrested too and disappeared. So nobody dared ask for them. So now on the 14th of October, Hitler made this fantastic speech saying that he was leaving the League of Nations, which was one of the conditions of the Versailles Treaty, and that he wasn't paying another penny of reparations, and that he was going to rearm, and that he was going to re-enter the demilitarized zone,
mm-hmm.
which all of which was against the Treaty of Versailles.
Mm-hmm.
My father says that man is mad. Now the French have a good reason to enter Germany. Germany had 100,000 men under arms. They didn't have one machine gun, not one warplane. They had a ridiculously small navy. They didn't have one cannon. How could they defend themselves against the French, who had a million men under arms? So let's turn on Radio Paris. So my father, as all well-educated Germans could speak French fluently.
Mm-hmm.
And I had French as my second foreign language, so I understood what the announcer was saying. And the announcer said, and now I hold my microphone out of the window here at the Place de Concorde, that's in the center of Paris, and listen to the crowd. And as far as you can see, there are heads. You couldn't get a vehicle anywhere on any of the avenue, of the boulevards or on this Place de Concorde. It is so crowded. And listen to the crowd chanting, and the crowd was chanting, "Au Berlin, au Berlin, to Berlin, to Berlin, to Berlin." So my father said, "That's war. You're not fighting for those bastards. You get out of Germany today." So we tried to go and walk to where he has this car garaged. You couldn't cross the street. There were stormtroopers marching, 12 abreast, bands of Hitler Youth and bugle corps and women's auxiliaries in blue uniforms and girl auxiliaries and tons of flags and banners flying and loud martial music. You couldn't cross the street. They had come from the railroad station and were marching into the city park, and that had, we were on the near that line. So we had to walk to downtown Hamburg, which was a beautiful walk along the Alster Lake, and we went to a British travel agency, Cook's Travel Agency, and got a one-way ticket to London.
Mm-hmm.
My father had an uncle in London, and my father telegraphed him that I was coming. Now, I had visited London in 1932 and had a valid passport.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no trouble getting the ticket. And at 2 o'clock that afternoon, we went to the railroad station, and the train was exactly on time. And the family was there, and some kids from across the street, and they waved me goodbye. And that was the last I had been to Hamburg for a long, long time, until I think 1985. So, or 86, I'm not sure. I think it was 86. So I was on my way
and
to
you,
England.
Yeah, so you got to London.
To London.
And stayed with your uncle.
And the sea was extremely rough.
Was it?
But I slept through it. And on the train, my father told me not to say a word to anybody, and I was allowed to take 100 marks with me. I had more saved from my pocket money, when I gave the rest of my money to my father. So 100 marks was, at that time, $25 US.
I see.
And so I arrived in London and in a fabulous house. For two weeks, until my granduncle found a berth on a empty banana boat to go to Jamaica, where I had an elder brother who had left after the crash in 1929 because there were no jobs in Germany.
Did a lot of Germans try to leave after that speech of Hitler's?
I don't think so.
They didn't.
Even though Hitler had pointed out in his book, the what do you call that book?
Mein
Kampf.
Mm-hmm.
My struggle or my fight or whatever you want. I don't know how. Kampf can be translated many ways.
Uh-huh.
It could be fight, struggle, war,
uh-huh.
Campaign.
Yeah.
So, Mein Kampf means my campaign, I would say. Anyway, he said everything he was going to do in Mein Kampf. And my uncle, who had been the treasurer of the city of Hamburg and was a Jew,
yes.
Leo Lippmann, Dr. Leo Lippmann, had come over to my parents, and usually my father sent me out when my an adult came, but my uncle said, no, I want all to be here. And he suggested that I leave Germany.
And that was that earlier?
Yeah, a little earlier.
Uh-huh.
Not
just but he foresaw.
I got kicked out of school.
But he foresaw trouble too.
He was in charge of the finance of the Jewish temple because he was kicked out of the government of Hamburg. And then he asked my father, "And when are we leaving, Paul?" And my father, my father asked Leo, "When are we leaving?" Leo said, "Oh, never. If all the politicians would leave now, then who will take over when Hitler is kicked out of office?" That was the attitude of most of the Jews, that Hitler was not there going to be there permanently, but an election would take place. Free elections were over. Nobody seemed to understand that free elections were over. Shortly after Hitler came to power and had arrested all the communists, there was an election. You went into the election office, you signed in, and you were numbered. And the ballots fell one on top of the other, so you could number them as you took them out. So anybody who had voted no
would be identified.
Was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no free election. Anyway, my uncle was wrong. It cost him his life and my aunt's life.
Do you know what happened to your uncle?
Yes. He was ordered to report to be transported to a labor camp, which was a death camp. And he and his wife took cyanide.
In their home?
Yeah, in their home.
What about your parents?
My parents left in 1936 after my grandmother died, my mother's mother. My mother didn't want to go in 1933 because her mother had diabetes and she didn't want to leave her. So I left for Jamaica, and there, not having any certificate of any education, I sort of got under the wheels. It was a rough crowd, and I just didn't fit in. And at first I worked in the bakery, but I was kicked out because, I don't know, the senior partner was a miserable guy. He didn't like me. Anyway, I was hungry. And out of a job.
Tell me what at that time, what was going on in Jamaica and what was their political affiliation?
Jamaica, British West Indies, was very British. There was an incipient independence movement, but it wasn't much to talk about. And it was a flourishing colony, and roads were being built and paved, and bridges were being built and paved, and it was definitely an upbeat country,
mm-hmm.
very much so. And I got a job in the Jamaica Public Service Company, which was owned by Russell V. Bell, the son of Graham Bell. And he owned a lot of power stations south of the border of the United States. And I was hired as one of the local people. I got $1.50 a week for 54 hours.
And what was your job?
Learning how to service refrigerators.
I see.
And I became very good at it.
Mm-hmm.
I serviced and installed refrigerators. But my pay was so poor. A pair of shoes cost twice as much as my week's pay.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always in trouble for money. And I lived with my brother, and he got married, and I lived with him and his wife, and I felt like a fifth wheel on a truck. So
was the economy in...
They were very nice. They were wonderful with me.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They were like parents to me, because I was only 15.
Sure.
And I had... Well, I started work when I was 16, and at the public service... I became 17 when I was at the public service.
Can I go back just one quick question? When you came from London to Jamaica, you came by sea?
Yes, well, it took 4 weeks. But it took 2 weeks.
Two weeks.
Yeah, my brother's ship had taken 4 weeks. It was a Hornliner from Hamburg.
Oh, yeah.
But the Ellison Fives, the banana boat, took 2 weeks. The first week, I didn't see another passenger. It was so stormy.
They were all below.
Seasick. And I was the only one who showed up for dinner. And after dinner, now I had put on a nice blue suit, as much English looking as I could possibly be. I spoke my very best English. And this officer who sat opposite me talked about nothing but seasickness and storms for dinner. And then I made a big mistake. I ordered coffee, and I didn't know that coffee makes you more seasick when you already feel woozy.
I didn't know that.
And then I had another cup of coffee because I felt awful after that first cup of coffee, and I felt even worse.
Oh.
Anyway, I got up, and the captain of the ship walked over to me, and now I was English. I was on an English ship.
Yes.
I was going to an English colony. And I had been to England to learn English. The captain comes up to me and says, "Young man, you deserve an Iron Cross, a German war decoration. That's the last thing I wanted." Anyway, I did feed the fish that night.
I bet.
But I never missed another meal. And for 1 week, I didn't see another passenger. And then after we passed the Azores, they all came out. They all looked like cream cheese.
Oh, yes. It's a funny color. Oh, yes. Yes.
Anyway, I made friends with a fellow who was a Cockney who was going to work at Masterton Limited in Kingston. He said he can't stand the British climate anymore. He has to... Doctor told him to go to a warm climate, and Masterton would hire him. So I made friends with him. And, well,
So that I didn't mean to interrupt your story about
yes.
your jobs.
Yeah. Well, I saw in the that a lot of neon tubes were imported in Jamaica, and they always broke. And they had a sign called Movies, which was in neon, which was imported from England, and it was broken. Nobody could fix it. So I asked the company if I went to New York and learned how to make neon signs, would I get my own department, and would I get the pay of a department head?
Uh-huh.
And they said yes. So I went to New York. I on January 1937, and I worked in the day in a refrigeration factory, putting in the water coolers. Into the water coolers, I put in the refrigeration equipment and tested it. So I was making a little better pay than I was making in Jamaica, but not very good. It was terribly prescient at the time, 1938. I was glad to get a job. And
now, what was your status? Were you on a visiting visa?
I was a factory worker.
But your passport would allow you to...
Oh, yes. I had a working permit. Mm-hmm. Yes, I had a working permit.
Okay.
And I went to school at nights. Monday nights, I went to New York Electrical School. Tuesday nights, I went to Brooklyn Tech to learn drawing and machining. And in the electrical school, I learned drawing and electrical work, how to wind motors.
How did you know how to do this? How did you know this was available?
The school taught me that. And then the Wednesday night, I went to a glass blowing school make neon signs. Thursday night, I was again at the New York Electrical School in Manhattan. And Friday night, I went back to Brooklyn Tech to learn machining and drawing. And Saturday afternoons and until late at night, I would go back to the neon school to learn glass blowing. And Sundays I mostly slept.
Where did you stay?
With my parents. I stayed with my parents.
Oh, your parents were in New York
yes,
by that time?
Yes, my parents had migrated to America in 1936 after my mother died.
I see.
My father opened an office as a general practitioner. In Hamburg, he was a urologist and a dermatologist.
Mm-hmm.
They usually were together.
Mm-hmm.
And but in New York, he was just a general practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the book of Who's Who in American Medicine.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
How did I miss that?
Yes.
What was his full name?
Paul Maximilian von der Porten.
That's right. Tell me, while we're on that, about the derivation. I know you've told me about the name von der Porten.
Oh. In 1644, a family named Knorr, K-N-O-R-R, moved to Hamburg. It was a Jewish family. And Mr. Knorr married the daughter of the president of the Jewish congregation in Hamburg. Apparently, both families were quite wealthy. And at that time, for a while at least, quite a few years, the city of Hamburg would not allow Jews to live within the city. So they lived in Schleswig-Holstein, which surrounds Hamburg. And Schleswig-Holstein was ruled by the kings of Denmark.
I see.
The kings of Denmark were the descendants of the rulers of Schleswig-Holstein. And that's how Schleswig-Holstein got under the Danish flag. And the kings of Denmark always needed money so the Jews could stay in Schleswig-Holstein as long as they paid a Jew tax or protection money. But they couldn't own any land. But they finally got permission to have a graveyard of their own, which they bought. They could trade in Hamburg, but when the gates were closed at nights, they had to be outside the city. So the Knorr family moved near the gates of Hamburg, outside of Hamburg, in Wandsbek. And there must have been several Knorr families, so they called my ancestors of the gate, von der Porten. And that is Low German, von der Porten, without the R, of the gates. And that's how the name von der Porten came about. Eventually, Jews were allowed to live in Hamburg, and they did live in Hamburg. Then the nobility, when it became mandatory throughout Germany to have family names, the name von der Porten stuck. And then the nobles insisted that only nobles could use von and von der and Zum and so on, and that commoners should not use von and so on. But Hamburg was a republic, and they couldn't care a hang with the nobles. So the name von der Porten was not changed.
Yeah.
And so many von and von der and Zum and so on live in Hamburg who are not nobles.
Yeah.
So our family never was noble. So it was just the location where they lived.
Yeah.
So instead of saying Knorr von der Porten, the Knorr was obliterated because there were several Knorr families.
Sure.
So make a distinction.
Sure.
So that is during about 1700, 1800. I can show you my family tree, and it's right there.
Well, let's go back to New York first.
Okay.
And you're going to school 5 nights a week.
Yes,
and working.
I was really exhausted. And then finally, my brother wrote me, "What are you doing? You should be working in a neon shop." So I quit school. Then I quit my job, and I found out as a neon man, you couldn't work in New York unless you had a union card from Local 3.
Oh.
And to get a union card from Local 3 was impossible because they had unemployed members.
Sure.
Finally, I found a job in a little shop that was all blacked out, all the straw windows were closed and everything, and the owner had a gun, rifle next to his place in case a local 3 man would come in and try to beat him up or kill him. And I worked there for a little while, but he then said, "No, it's too dangerous, I can't take the responsibility." So I went to Maine, there was a guy who wanted a glass blower. He was somewhat crazy. And he had a shop full of broken glass. So I worked to get all that glass fixed. And it was February. The temperature outside was minus 30. And he asked me to service neon signs, climbing on a ladder, and I took off my gloves and my fingers froze against the glass immediately. So I realized I can't use my bare hands, and I broke the glass. I couldn't get my fingers off the glass. So that was another repair to make. And the guy, the house was, he said that I would stay in his house. Yeah, but the house wasn't heated. Only the kitchen was heated. And I was up in the attic, and the wash water was frozen every morning.
Oh.
In my room.
So how long did you stay with him?
I stayed there a few weeks, and after 3 weeks or so, I said, no, I'm not going to stay in that house. And he had another helper who was from across the river. I think it's the Kennebec River. And he spoke French as his native tongue.
Uh-huh.
Found out 75% of the people speak French. But they don't go to school, because at school they have to learn English, and the parents don't want them to learn English. They're all strict Catholics, but can't afford the money to go to a Catholic school. So he was practically, he was illiterate. But he gave me a room in a similar house, very old house, no insulation, but it was heated. So I got a nice room there, and when I came home from work, they handed me the newspaper in French. So I didn't bring my French dictionary. So I read to them, because none of them could read. His parents couldn't read, his sisters, his brothers,
oh, sure.
their spouses, and the little children, none of them could read. So without me reading the newspaper to them, they wouldn't get any news.
No.
They didn't have money to buy a radio either.
No.
So every evening I had to read the newspaper in French, and I didn't understand what I was reading. But without them, without me, they wouldn't know.
Oh,
what
dear.
Was. And they were very happy about that. But eventually all the neon tubing and all was repaired, and there was only one job left. It was a Saturday morning. And he told me that he had to let me go, but he owed me a week's pay. That was $10.
Mm-hmm.
$10 was a lot of money in those days. So he came into the shop with me, which he never used to do. And as I was making the connection for the bombarder, and you know, to get a neon tube ready to light, you have to evacuate it, bake it out, and then evacuate the dirt out of it, and then fill in the neon. And this bombarder has about three times the voltage as the electric chair in New York. So as I was touching the, I was just about touching both electrodes. As I was touching one, he threw the switch. I was flung across the room. I thought my back was broken. I had bought very thick rubber sole shoes, because the floor was so cold.
Yes.
Now those rubber sole shoes saved my life.
Why did he do that?
He wanted to kill me because he didn't want to pay me the $10.
Really?
So he ran, oh, it's an accident. I followed him upstairs into his kitchen, and there was his wife, and he sat next to his wife. He said, "It was an accident, it was an accident." I said, "I want my $10. So he paid me the $10, and I went outside to go home. And I saw his daughter. She was quite pretty, about 17 years old. And she was in tears. I said, "What's the trouble?" She says, "Now again, we won't have a glass blower for years, for months and months, and no money coming into the house." So I went down into the cellar and finished the job. Oh. A woman's tears.
Oh, she got to you.
Yeah.
And you were how old? You weren't very much older, were you?
I was about 20. Uh-huh. Not quite, 19.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I fixed it. I felt sorry also for the whole family.
Sure.
This guy was a retired circus clown. He was no good at all.
Well, now, what did you do for a job after that?
Well, I went back to New York, and I did a refrigeration job, but the guy I did it for cheated me out of my money. So my sister Irma didn't like me to go with her crowd, and I didn't really like the crowd, mostly German refugees and Brooklyn Jews, and they were all communists. And I asked them, "How can you be Zionists and communists at the same time?" As far as I'm concerned, they are mutually exclusive terms, because Zionists are very nationalistic, very religious. The communists are not religious and want international no borders. "Oh, you don't understand." So they told me I don't understand. I really didn't understand. And to top it off, the Soviet Union never did recognize Israel until Gorbachev took over. And after the Soviet Union imploded. So I was right, I think, anyway. But...
So what did you do for a job?
I looked for a job. I couldn't find a job, not for love or money. I got a letter from the public service company. If I wanted my job back, I still went to the neon school, though.
Uh-huh, I see.
Yeah. I got a letter from the public service company. If I wanted my job back, I would have to come now.
That's in Jamaica.
Yeah, back to Jamaica. So I was so happy. I hated New York. I didn't fit in at all. So I took the next banana boat from United Fruit Company back to Jamaica. My father gave me the money. And it was great to see the ocean again and the tropics and the swimming club. You see, I was a good swimmer in school already. I was the best swimmer in my school, in my class. And now in Jamaica, I was the best breaststroke swimmer. I was trying to, for the championship. Anyway, I went back to Jamaica and I got back to the public service and took over the commercial refrigeration service.
Uh-huh.
I installed walk-in coals, electric dairies, showcases, and
what year was this? What year did you get back to Jamaica?
1938. I had been in New York a year and a half.
Okay.
And 1938, and then I saw a water polo game. There was a German, an Austrian Jew Walter Lowy, who was an all-star in the Austrian team, but he was Jewish, and he saw the handwriting on the wall, and he fled to Jamaica, and he trained a league of water polo players, mostly high school boys.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was good. He was a great coach. And in 1938, Hitler sent the Emden, a training ship for officers for the German Navy in general, which was brand new. The Navy was brand new, mm-hmm. but the Emden was an old ship. And he stuffed all the top German athletes into Navy uniforms. And I walked down King Street. I met my friend's classmate.
Really?
And yeah, he was in a spanking white midshipman's uniform.
Uh-huh.
So I greeted him, and he said he had been an actor in a film in South America, and now he's in the Navy, and he was sailing regattas in Hamburg. He was good on the lake.
Yeah.
So now he was in the Navy, a midshipman. But then the swastika on his chest irritated me, and I made the conversation short. But I found out that they were going to play water polo against the Jamaican team.
Uh-huh.
So I went down to the Bournemouth Club, where I was practicing swimming anyway, and the Jamaican team appeared, all boys about 135 pounds, about 5'8".
Yeah.
And brown. And there was the all Aryan super race team of German. They're seven, all. And the shortest was 6 foot tall and at least 250 pounds.
Oh my gosh.
And the tallest was maybe 6 foot three and maybe close to 300 pounds. I said, my God, those poor little fellows are going to get crushed. So the Germans bellowed, Sieg Heil, with their outstretched hand. In those days, the rules were different from modern water polo. First of all, the ball was leather, and when it touched the water, it was dead in the water. And it was so heavy that if you stopped it with your face, you got a nosebleed.
Oh.
That was sure, and you were dizzy for a few seconds. And the main difference was that in those days there was no substitution.
Oh.
And nowadays they field two teams and they constantly substitute.
Sure, sure.
But in those days only two halves, 15 minutes of actual play. So when the ball was out of play,
yeah,
it wouldn't count. And now they have three sections, three 15 minute periods. But the ball tends to skip.
Yes.
It's a light plastic ball. Plastic was not invented at that time. Anyway, the teams got into the water. Their first was a relay. And in that relay, the Germans beat the Jamaican team just by a hair.
Uh-huh.
And then in the water, the first whistle blew, the ball is thrown in the middle of the pool and the teams from the goal line swim for that ball. Well, the Jamaicans got the ball. They passed it back to their fullback. The fullback saw one of his forwards open. Forward got the ball and scored 1-0 Jamaica. Few seconds, they swim back to the goal line. Same thing, 2-0 Jamaica. Couldn't believe it. I hear the German captain say, Hopen. That means play rough.
Ah.
The next thing, the third time, the Jamaicans were out. They all got bloody noses. And they did score anyway, 3-0. I hear the Jamaican captain say, "Let's drown them."
Oh, really?
So the Jamaicans get the ball and pass it to the side. The Germans tries to get the ball, Jamaican gets there first, pass it to the other side, same thing happens.
Oh my gosh.
Passing the ball from side to side, the Germans were so exhausted they couldn't
really
breathe. The Jamaicans swim laps every day, or at least 3 times a week. They can't do that on a warship. So near the end of the second half, by that time the Germans could hardly swim. The Jamaican captain says, "Let's score." When the ball was out, I heard him say, "Let's score."
Uh-huh.
And score 2 more, 5-0 Jamaica. When you're in the water, the bigness doesn't help too much.
No, it doesn't. In fact, it probably is a deterrent. You got a lot to haul around.
Huge fellows. But they could swim pretty well. Short distance, yes, they beat the
But
Jamaicans.
Not to outlast the
but
Jamaican.
What, a quarter of an hour. And then only 5 minutes break time. Boy, the Jamaicans beat them. And then I said, okay, then. Let's play the different clubs. And they played the different clubs. I couldn't go because it was work time for me.
But did you play?
They did score against what not never won.
Yeah.
They never won.
So but did you get on the team?
So,
Did you swim with them?
Eventually I went, oh yes, I was all-star. See my team there?
Oh, there you are.
Yeah, all-star goalie. I was the all-star goalkeeper for Jamaica from 1939 to 1953.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I was a tremendous athlete.
Well, and this was while you were working as...
A
refrigeration
mechanic, yeah.
Now, how long did you do that in Jamaica?
No, I went to the manager... to the chief engineer and said, "You know, when I went to America, you promised me that I would be a head of a department. Now I get next to no pay at all. I can't possibly live on that pay. And you haven't even discussed the neon shop with me." He says, "Well, Mr. Nichols, who was the manager at the time of the Promise, has died, and we have changed our policy. We don't want any more departments. We want to just sell electricity." So I said, "What? On the strength of your promise, I went to New York to study how to do that." He says, "Well, that was good for you. You didn't lose anything. There's no contract. And we are not going to start a neon shop." I said, "Well, how about a decent pay of a department head of them? Because I'm now the more or less in charge of refrigeration." Says, "Well, if you were born Canadian or American or English or maybe even Jamaican, sure you would get a decent pay, but as a German, forget it." So my ears burned like fire. And I went outside and went back to my shop. Next thing, I get a telephone call. I was never department head. An Englishman had to be a department head. He never did any work. He just sat at his desk all day long. He ordered the parts that we needed. That's it. He called me. I must speak to the phone. So it was Mr. Campbell. Mr. Campbell was a Jamaican. he had founded the company. He had sold it to the Americans. The Americans had enlarged it, but he was the one who really understood the net, the power net. So, but he always got a boss from America to boss him because he was colored. So he was lightly colored, brown man, and he told me to sit down. He was very polite. He said that the company has a policy that they will support companies that sell electricity. So if I sell neon signs, I will support, I will sell electricity. And he says, well, do you want to start your own neon shop? You can buy all the equipment and stock through the company, and you pay us back as you go, use your own time and term to pay us back. There'll be no interest because we will make the money from the electricity you sell. I said, oh yes, certainly I would take that. Well, he says, I'll make arrangements with the purchasing department that you can buy what you want. So I bought neon equipment in Brooklyn, and I bought it in New York. I forgot the name of the neon company now. Anyway, Tube Light was the company. They are a big sign supply company. So I bought what I needed to start a neon shop. And my brother and his wife, my brother was a salesman for the public service, but his wife was running a macaroni factory at that time. So I made a neon sign, Dora Macaroni, and one outside. And then the Anglo-American Tobacco Company asked me to put up a large sign, 11 by 22 feet, on top of downtown Kingston. So that was a big job. So I could use their flasher, but I had to revamp it. Everything was broken down, and it was a bulb sign originally, and I had to take out all the everything but the frame.
But you were up and running for a couple of good jobs.
I made a sign, smoke four aces cigarettes, and it was flashing in different stages. So that was a big job. And end of August 1939, we all stood there and saw the sign come on for the first time. The manager of the tobacco company, Mr. Masterton, who was did my sheet metal work, myself, my brother, and his wife, and I felt real good.
I guess so.
I really felt good.
Well, those signs were really, really popular, I guess, after that.
Yes.
I mean, any big city of any worth
had. So that was a Monday. On Sunday morning, Mr. Chamberlain's words came over the radio at about 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
And we are now at war with Germany.
Oh.
And I was locked up. Five policemen came in a station wagon, and I had to sit beside them. And they had a gun drawn. I must have looked really dangerous. And I was a lot.
Well, you know those Germans. I mean, you can't trust them. Oh, Arnold. So you were off to an internment camp?
Internment camp.
Now, was this in Kingston? Was this in Kingston?
In Kingston, yes, near the military camp. So it was a military prison. They had 10 cells. my brother and I got into one cell, and we were 22 people.
Oh.
So one pair had to sleep in a tent. Now, as we were interned, we immediately split into two groups. One was for a German victory, and one was for a British victory. We chose Dr. Lomberg to be our spokesman with the authorities. Dr. Lomberg was a dentist from Hamburg. And Mr. Dieters, who was the consul for Germany, was chosen by the others to represent them. Now, Dieters was a very pleasant person. He employed, among others, a Jewish salesman.
Mm-hmm.
But he had to join the party if he wanted to represent German firms. He was a commission agent.
Yes.
So he joined the party, and they made him a consul. But he wasn't officially recognized as such, so he was interned. If he had been officially recognized, he would have been sent back to Britain and then exchanged. So, Mr. Dieters, he was very friendly with me. I will never say anything against him. But he was now officially my enemy. And the Nazis made it a rule that they wouldn't talk to us, and that was good. Because we didn't want to get into any fights.
Yeah.
Neither verbal nor physical. We were 11 and 11, and it wouldn't help the war in any way. So I was chosen to help with the food, and others the toilet and the washstand and so on. The first night, my brother and I were locked up in a cell. It was maybe 8 foot by maybe 6 foot. And the grill made a terrible shadow on the wall, white wall. It was terrible. And the doors were locked tight.
Yeah.
There was no facilities in the cell whatsoever.
Oh.
And there was a bulb in the middle. It was turned off at 10 o'clock sharp. And that bulb was encased in wire so you couldn't touch it. There was a chair that was cemented into the floor, and a little table about this, about 2 foot wide and 1 foot six long, and that was cemented in. And the cots were so uncomfortable. I never slept on anything that uncomfortable in my life. Anyway, that was the first night, and that shadow kept me awake. And eventually I did sleep. And in the morning, two fellows arrived, two other Germans arrived, and they were very strongly anti-Nazi. One claimed to be a relative of mine from Berlin. I don't know him. I didn't know him anyway. He was just like myself, of Jewish father and Christian mother. And the other one was all Christian. He was a nobleman. He wore a ring from the nobility. He was a Quaker.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to be in our group. So another tent had to be erected. But Schoenbeck, who was the chief sugar chemist at the Fohm sugar estate, and that was the only sugar refinery, and he was the only chief sugar chemist who really knew about it. They had to follow his path, but there was nobody now to be in really running it, the technical part.
Sure.
Anyway, he was interned. He didn't want to sleep in a tent, so I said, I'm going to sleep in the tent. and I met Willy Gertig. And that was the luckiest choice.
Mm-hmm.
Because Willy was a Quaker. It didn't mean a thing to me at first. But the next morning, or was it that same afternoon, maybe the same afternoon, after we rigged up our tent and made a little berm around it so that water wouldn't run in,
mm-hmm.
the Quakers from Highgate, which is 30 miles in the mountains, so it's very difficult to get there because gasoline was stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they came and brought him his clothes, a cake and cookies and candies and cigarettes. He was a terrible smoker. And so all of that was brought into our tent now. And there was this guard who brought this stuff. And Willie said, sit down, have some candy and some fruit with us. Well, the guard was very much surprised. Sat down with us and started a very friendly conversation. And after a while he left. And I said to Willie, you know, Willie, I would have never, never asked a guard to help me.
Yes.
Help himself. Those damn hypocrites, they claim they're fighting for democracy and they lock up the Jews in the same tent, in the same camp with the Nazis, and treat us just like that. And then Willie said, you know, Arnold, you must learn to forgive. That guy is a pre-war volunteer. He probably never was able to find a job in England. Nobody is going to send him anything nice. He must be very homesick. And if you have a grudge against something, somebody, that guy won't feel that grudge. You feel it, you get an ulcer. So forgive. So, really surprised me. Anyway.
I bet you gave that a lot of thought.
Hmm?
I bet you gave that a lot of thought.
Yeah. And then Willie, and then the guards and the prisoners got on beautifully together at all times.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. And then we did our chores. And after a few days, Gerhard was released. My brother was released because his naturalization papers had come through from England.
I see.
And he was released.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed with Willie. And on the 15th of November, I was released after being interviewed by a review board. So all of us in the so-called Jew group were released, but not Willie and three Jewish fellows, and I don't understand the reasoning why those three were kept.
Do you know why they released you?
Huh?
Do you know the reason they released you?
Yes, because I immigrated there legally into Jamaica, and I was well known, and the review board must have given me a good name.
I see.
So I was released and I started my neon shop again, but of course no outdoor signs, was block out.
Oh, that's right, sure.
And then I did a lot of mechanical work for all kinds of people because nothing could be thrown away, it had to be repaired.
Sure.
There was nothing new.
Sure.
Then the war went terribly. At first, nothing happened. For months, nothing happened. And suddenly, the Germans marched through Holland, Belgium, and France, and took France in absolutely no time at all. The Maginot Line was supposed to be impenetrable. Well, first of all, the Germans bombed Amsterdam. No, not Amsterdam, Rotterdam, something terrible. And I didn't know at that time, but my cousin, who was my age and she was pregnant, was picked up by the Nazis and put into Oranienburg, one of the concentration camps, and burnt. And my Uncle Ernst, who had given me the anesthetic, he was in Belgium, and he fled, and he was arrested by the Vichy French and put into a concentration camp in southern France, where eventually he and his wife committed suicide because they were supposed to be shipped back to Germany. Mm. Well, I didn't know all that at the time, but I did my best to make a living in Kingston without being able to import any material.
Sure.
And
did you stay in touch with your parents? Hmm? Did you stay in touch with your parents in New York?
Yes, I did. Even in the camp, I wrote them letters.
And could you stay up on the news? Did you have a radio? Did you have access to the news?
Yes, I had news. And the news were British victories all over the world. It was real rubbish.
Yeah.
It was real rubbish.
Yeah.
So nobody trusted the news anymore. And nobody believed that the German submarines at first did enormous damage to the British fleet, but then the British broke the code. Mm-hmm. And knew where the submarines were.
Yes.
And their supply ships. And the crews of the supply ships were shipped to Jamaica.
Oh.
And they were hand-picked Nazis. They were really hand-picked Nazis. They went into the internment camp. A new internment camp was built.
Uh-huh.
So I was glad I wasn't in there.
I would say so.
But then the Nazis went into Denmark and Norway, and a tremendous fifth column scare started. Mm-hmm. This fifth column scare was absolutely unreasonable because it was local people who supported the enemy.
Yes.
Not German refugees. Mm-hmm. So they locked us all up again.
Oh, really?
Yes.
When was that? That was later in
May 1940.
Okay.
I was on a ladder putting the last touches on a sign, on a illumination inside a store. Mm-hmm. When a guy tapped me on my leg and said, "You're under arrest." I started to water, but I could tell my brother I'm locked up and let him pay you and finish his job. So he did. A few weeks afterwards, my brother too was interned, but in a different camp because he was British. They gave him much better accommodation.
Uh-huh.
Each one had his own room. So, and my sister-in-law. So the three of us were in three different camps. And the women's camp was so horrible, so absolutely horrible, that six of the women committed suicide.
Oh.
It was 60 women were interned, 10% committed suicide. There were any amount of little babies in that camp, and the black woman who ran it says now she can get revenge on the white people.
Oh.
And they were in tiny little rooms under, my sister-in-law was under the staircase, that was her room. Anytime somebody walked up and down the stairs, it was like thunder. Anyway, Hitler proclaimed on the radio that if the women in Jamaica weren't treated better, he would treat the British women the same way.
Really?
Yeah, the Swiss consul apparently
reported it.
Head of the Red Cross had reported. So the women got a better camp, and the black woman was replaced with a deaconess of the Methodist Church. Mm-hmm. And the black soldiers who were walking inside that camp, so the women had no privacy whatsoever, were ordered to get out of the camp and stay outside.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
how long then were you interned the second time?
Well, to the end of the war. I wasn't interned to the end of the war, but most of the women and most of the others, the Jew group was gradually released. But not Willie and three other Jews were not. Anyway, the camp now was 1,200.
Oh my gosh.
And about a third of them were these sailors.
Oh, from the ship,
from the ships, yeah. But the British had made a sweep of south of the Sahara and all of Africa, just south, north and south of the Sahara Desert. And all Germans and Italians found there, whether Jewish or Christian, were arrested and shipped to Jamaica.
Really? I didn't know that.
So our Jew group became about 10 more than originally. And my future doctor was interned there with me, Dr. Alp. And Dr. Lomberg was a camp dentist. And there was an incident. The military, by that time, Canadian volunteers took over and the English went home.
Ah, yes.
And I was sorry for those Canadians afterwards because they were shipped to Hong Kong and they were decimated there and almost all of them were killed. Anyway, at that time I didn't know that. But their dentists couldn't do oral operations. And Dr. Lomberg could get his equipment out of his office, and there was no electricity. The camp had 220 volts, whereas Jamaica had 110 volts, 40 cycles. So the British camp had 220, 50 cycles. So instead of having an electric drill. His brother, who had been a Nazi internment camp before he was in Jamaica, had to sit there and pedal on a bicycle.
I knew you were going to say that.
To move the drill.
Oh.
So there was a sailor who had an impacted wisdom teeth. The Canadian dentist said, no, he can't do that. So Dr. Lomberg got the job, and one of the ship's doctors gave the anesthetic.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Lomberg chiseled away at that wisdom tooth, and after he was under, he yelled, Heil Hitler, Heil Hitler, and ever, forever Heil Hitler, Heil Hitler. It's a wonder Dr. Lomberg didn't drill right through his...
Oh, not a good plan. Not a good plan.
Anyway, the whole camp had a good amusement.
I would think so. It's not the kind of thing in a vulnerable position like that.
Anyway.
Well, what was it like when you learned the war was over?
Oh, well, first of all, in the internment camp, that was To me, my college, it was like a college because Willie was my number one teacher.
Your professor. Ever.
We saw, first of all, the wood we got for the kitchen fire, and I was the cook.
Yes.
It was a root of lignum vitae. It was almost as big as a room.
Really?
And so we used an axe, and the axe didn't make any impression. We broke the axe handle, but the lignum vitae wouldn't split off.
Is that like lighter wood? Is that what they call it?
It's a very, very hard wood.
I think I know what it is. That's all right, Arnold.
Anyway, here.
Okay.
It's a very, very hard wood, cross-grained.
Okay.
And we had to use a 12-pound sledgehammer and a chisel to get that off. One has to hold the chisel and the other hits with a 12-pound sledgehammer.
Oh, my gosh.
So we found some scrap wood, which the builders had left when they cast the foundations for the toilets and washstands and so on, and the kitchens. And we made ourselves kind of tongs. There had been left barbed wire inside the camp when it was expanded, and we pulled out the pins out of the ground, a pin out of the ground, heated it in the kitchen fire and drilled through the wood, and then made a rivet to fasten it, and that made our tongue, and we could hold the chisel. Anyway, Willie said, "You know, Arnold, we have no furniture. No, we just, for, I don't remember how many we were, but we were, I think, 22 now. There's no, we have these four benches and these two tables, and if you want to sit down, you have to sit down on your cot. So we need chairs." I said, "Willie, where are you going to get chairs from?" He said, "See all the scrap wood they left you. Just let's collect some of the scrap wood." So we collected the scrap wood. And at first we used the floor to file the concrete floor to file the wood.
Yeah.
And we used the pins from the barbed wire to drill holes. And then the Quakers were allowed to send in tools, but we had to turn them in at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
The Quakers were the only ones outside who cared for any of the prisoners. Yeah. The other religions didn't seem to care. There were 12 priests interned and one bishop.
Really?
From Africa. They were missionaries in Africa. And they had some contact with the priests in Jamaica. But the other religions didn't seem to care. Rab said he tried everything to help us, but he can't. So that's the one visit he made to us, and that was it. He was no good. But the Quakers always helped. So they sent in tools, and we took the scrap wood, and Willie and I together made a very nice deck chair. We found an Italian sailor who seemed to take an interest in us. And this sailor was a fisherman at one time, and he could knot nets faster than Willie. Willie was originally a handicraft teacher.
Oh, really?
In Germany, he was a certified handicraft teacher, and he was absolutely fabulous. And so this guy made the nets, And we made the frames, and we had made folding chairs. And the very first one was a nice deck chair, very comfortable.
How wonderful.
And Willie gave it to the laziest, most miserable guy in our group. I said, Willie, I thought that was for you. What you give him, that guy of all guys, he wouldn't move a finger for anybody. Willie said, Arnold, that man probably never experienced the pleasure of receiving something from somebody for nothing. Maybe it will help him to get over this grudge against the whole world. I said, Willie, why do you do all that? He says, well, I'm a Quaker. I've dedicated my life to helping others. Well, Willie was a missionary, and he didn't even feel like a prisoner. His mission was right there in the internment camp.
He was in his place, wasn't he?
So he said, all right, we'll make this, these chairs, and each one of us got a chair. We were 22.
Mm-hmm.
And we made these chairs, and this Italian fellow knitted the, knotted the string to make the backs and the seats. So Willie said, look at all this wood, we could make a loom. I said, Willie, because we got a book. He got a book from the Quakers. Among other things, there was a loom in there. Look at this loom. So there was a photograph of a loom. I said, well, how? From what? He said, scrap wood. So we scrounged around and found a lot of scrap wood. And between the two of us, we built a loom.
Amazing.
So after the loom was built, the Quaker sent in a broken spinning wheel, which we fixed. Then they sent in a sheet, a carder. Well, that is a comb, a little rubber thing.
Yes, yes, I know what you mean.
Bent hook nails in it.
Yes.
To comb the wood. So we made a little wheel on and mounted it on it and handled it.
Where did you get the wool?
And then the Quaker sent in butcher's wool.
Butcher's wool.
That means from sheep that had been slaughtered.
And so here you...
So we had butcher's wool. We washed it. We carded it. And he taught me how to spin it. So I learned how to spin wool. And we made blankets. The combs and the heddles for a loom, you know what I mean?
I don't know what a heddle is.
Heddles are the things that move the
that move
string
the up and down.
Yeah.
Okay.
It needs a lot of wire. I straightened out hundreds of feet of barbed wire. With a hammer and a stone.
Yes.
Straightened out. So we cut them all the same length.
Amazing.
And
was that from the barbed wire?
And that, what?
Where did you get the wire?
From the barbed wire.
From the barbed
wire.
Inside
the camp.
The things you made out of leftovers.
Yes. And we got some nice blankets. And when I got married, those were the only blankets we had. I was so poor after the war. So we just did that. And then... My brother was also interned in a different camp, and I was allowed to visit him once a week. So, and in the meantime, the women were treated a little better. But eventually they let me go, but they kept Willie. Now, Willie is a perfectionist. So after his way of treating other people, he got others to help him with getting a garden going. He said, if people, idleness is the worst enemy. It can cause mental illness. So he got a garden going. And the Quaker set in the seeds.
Of course.
And so we had a garden in front of our hut. Then one night, I forgot the exact date, but it was somewhere around the 15th of June, 1940, Hitler suddenly attacked the Russians. And the camp newspaper, which was printed by the Nazis, you know, by typewriter, stated that the Russians attacked Germany. There were four men living with the Nazis, who the Nazis claimed were communists. Actually, they had been in South America somewhere, not participating in any war. But they didn't want to be called Nazis, and they didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
So the Nazis called them communists because Molotov and von Ribbentrop had made a pact together, and so they were communists were tolerated. Mm-hmm. Now, 20 men each beat each one of those four men. 80 men beat those four men, 80 sailors. Two of them got such bad brain injury that they died. They strung one from the rafters, and to prevent the British from seeing what they were doing, they made a short circuit and the camp lights were all out. So the British stormed the camp with drawn bayonets and cut this guy off from the ceiling, but he died eventually from brain injuries. So, and two of them came into our group, and the other two went to the hospital and died. But that was a very scary night. The screaming was horrible. It was a horrible night. But eventually they let me go. And I did all kinds of mechanical work, and I finally got the idea of making gas producers. Nobody had gasoline.
Yeah.
So I made out of two 55-gallon drums a gas producer to run trucks on charcoal.
Oh, so that you use charcoal as the fuel?
Charcoal as fuel. By burning the charcoal with a limited air supply, you get carbon monoxide.
Mm-hmm.
And the engine of the car will suck in that carbon monoxide, and you mix it with air, and it's an explosive. So the trucks run very nicely on this mixture.
How did you know how to do this?
Well, I saw a picture in a book of a carbon of that. And the way it was shown is that the coal is an insulator and it will only burn where the oxygen is.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of the tank is more or less cold. So where the intake is, it's terribly hot.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a double wall intake, had a radiator on top with water, and the water was coming in from underneath, went through the double wall, which had a feather, so the water had to go all the way to the front before it could go to the top, and went back into the radiator. So it was water cooled. And then I got some discarded two-inch tubing and laid it under the truck, and I had a filter there, coil filter, and then another oil filter right before it goes into the truck. And then in the truck I had a, instead of the, underneath the carburetor, a butterfly valve, which I connected to the foot pedal.
I see.
And to the choke, I connected the gasoline, put a little gasoline in the carburetor, started the truck, which gave a suction, and somebody in the back had to take a newspaper, burning newspaper, and it sucked into the hole, and it would burn right away, and the truck would drive.
And did you keep this for yourself?
No, I did it for next to nothing, and those guys who I made it for, they bought half of Kingston, one of them, and the other bought another town. Bought the whole town.
Oh, my
because
goodness.
They were the only ones who could drive a civilian. I did three trucks, and then the government, in their miserable discrimination, stopped the Chinese bakers from having their kneading machinery, kneading the dough.
Yeah.
So one guy came to me and asked me if I could run a motor car engine and drive his machinery with a gas producer. So it was in the countryside and they were Chinese. So I took my bicycle. It was a long ride uphill, and I stayed there. After I made it in the town, we took it up with a dray. You know, it's a mule-drawn vehicle with two wheels.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they got it up there, and I went there by bicycle, and I stayed with him for until I had it all rigged up. And they didn't have any knife and fork, so I had to learn to eat with chopsticks.
Why, you're just, your time in Jamaica was just a learning school the whole time, wasn't it?
So, but I got their bakery running very nicely with a motor car, old Ford engine. And
what year did you do that? Do you remember?
All the war was going on, 41 or 42.
I see.
Or during the war. I don't remember exactly the years, but before armistice at any rate. And then the macaroni factory got a letter from the government that they would not allow only 10% of the current they were using.
Oh, the electrical current?
Yeah, so that was enough to run the fans to evaporate the air out of the macaroni and vermicelli and so. But it wasn't enough to run the machinery. So I got a motor car engine there, and I made a gas producer there, and
my
ran
goodness.
The machinery with a chain through the door, and it ran very nicely. Nice and quietly.
Well, does this mean you were becoming a multimillionaire in Jamaica?
I was not making any money. That's the trouble. I did never knew how to make money. So, at any rate, I did all kinds of work to keep myself alive. And but it was interesting. But the most important thing is the time with Willie, I changed completely from a very, unforgiving person to a very forgiving person.
Well, you saw how it worked for him.
Yeah, he was wonderful. He was wonderful. Anyway, I'm going to show you the blankets in a little while.
Okay. Tell me, when you found out about the end of the war, or how you found out?
Oh, the end of the war. Well, I was walking, I think I was going to a swimming meet, and somebody told me that an atomic bomb had been exploded in Hiroshima that wiped out the whole city. Well, knowing the press and its exaggerations and everything else, I didn't believe it.
Yeah.
But then the bomb on Nagasaki came, and the Japanese had surrendered and that the war was over. Well, I felt very good about the war being over. I had no idea of the extent of the damage those bombs had done.
No.
And I felt that if the bombs had done that, end the war, that was a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, had you met Amy by this time?
Well, that's a different story. Just in January 1939, or was it February? January, about, I think it was the 17th of January.
You better get this right, because I'll ask Amy.
Yeah, 1939.
Okay.
Before the war, I was a member of the swimming club, and in Jamaica, the schools were separated. Well, girls and boys went to different schools. Mm-hmm. So at the Sweet 16 party of a girl, the brothers had to rustle up boys to go to this coming out party.
Sure.
So Amy's friend Elise Hill was 16, and Eric Hill was a member of the swimming club. So he asked me if I would come to his house to the Sweet 16 party of his sister. And I said I would be delighted. So there was this party, and I didn't know how to dance. So I just stood around most of the time and watched, and I didn't drink, and I didn't smoke.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the fellows, they had rigged up on the lawn, they had rigged up a bar. Most of the fellows were there at the bar, and the girls sat in the living room, which had been cleared, so it had a nice parquet floor, and the guys came in and danced with the girls, but some girls just didn't get anybody to dance with them. And there was this tall, dangling girl sitting with another girl who was very popular and danced every dance, but this tall girl, never danced. Nobody asked her. She was kind of underdeveloped, and she was taller than the rest. So finally, Mrs. Hill came up to me and says, "Albert, go and dance with this one. She's a real wallflower. Nobody asked her to dance." I say, "Okay." Okay, all right. So I go up to this girl and make my best bow. I had a nice tie and my shoes were polished for affection. This girl had a nice dress on and very nice looking dress. And the other girl, who is popular, gets up and dances with me, leads me to the dance floor, and we dance. And she could make amends for my clumsiness as far as a dancer is concerned. Now, I was 20 at the time. No, 21. 21 at the time. Just before the war, remember. The war broke out in 1939. And Mama Hill comes up to me and says, "Not that one, you dope." "Go to the other one." I said, "Mama Hill, what am I going to do?" I go up to this girl, I make my best bow, and the other girl gets up.
Mm-hmm.
She says, "You don't do it right." I said, "Well, how do you do it?" "You go up to the girl, and you hold her arm, What, me? Grab a girl by the arm? He says, no, don't grab her. Just touch her gently. She'll lead you to the dance floor. Well, I had been in all kinds of trouble, but this one was, well, as worthwhile trying. So I tried it. I touched the girl on the arm. They danced it. The band was playing a two-step. The music was playing a two-step. She leads me to the floor. She wants to dance a foxtrot. So the two of us can't get together. Now this 15-year-old girl had never danced before. And I was clumsy as can be in dancing. Girls didn't want to go out with a damn German. So I didn't know how to dance. Anyway, we couldn't dance together. So I said, well, all you do is, I've just been to America, and that's true. I had been in 37, 38, I'd been in America.
Yes.
And I learned this dance. You just fling your leg this way and then that way, and you get together fine. So I flung my leg this way and then that way, and she followed suit and came out all right. And nobody's seen a dance like that before. It was the time of foxtrot and so everybody stood around, stopped dancing, made a circle around us and
clapped. The very latest thing.
My ears burned way up here and the girl got redder. And finally, I see a man at the door, he had a pipe in his mouth. She says, bye. That's the only word she ever said to me. And she was gone, as was her father taking her home.
I bet. But that wasn't Amy.
That was Amy. She was 15.
I see.
So when I came out of the internment camp, my brother had the idea of making vinegar out of sugar because he thought sugar will pile up on the wharf. There's no shipping space for anything except essential things.
Yes.
So I go to the library to see if there's a book on how to make sugar, vinegar out of sugar. So I go in the stacks. I don't know where to look. Finally, this girl comes up to me and she smiles, and I tell her what I want. She gives me the book. In the meantime, Gerhard finds out that sugar, because they make explosives from sugar. So he forgets about
the vinegar.
And I never even opened the book, but I had to bring it back. So I bring it back, and she says, how you do, Mr. Van der Porten? She knows my name. I said to her, didn't we dance together at one time? She says, yes, we did. And so I returned the book. She knows my name, but I don't know her name now. So I say, well, could I take you to a dance? There was a dance coming up at the Myrtle Bank Hotel, which is a swanky place. And she says, oh, she's sorry. And she wore this big button, the Victoria League. That's, the girls would entertain British and American officers. So she was entertaining some British officer or something. So I asked another girl to go to that dance, but I kept watching her. And there were these British officers getting drunk and drunker and more drunk. And this girl that I was with, she didn't seem to like to be seen with a German. Anyway, we didn't hit it off at all. So one of the officers looked as if he was going to get into a fight, and Amy was getting right between them, and she was going to get hurt. So I was getting up. This girl sitting beside me says, "You want to go back to internment camp?" I sat down.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
So I sat down. But the guys were not fighting, so everything was all right. But then later on, a few days later, I see her and this other very popular girl go into the theater, movie theater. So I go sit down right behind them. So this other girl spots me and starts talking. Say, "Amy, this guy's..." No. Amy doesn't turn around. It's bad manners to turn around in the movies. So she was strict as far as manners are concerned. So I asked them for an ice cream during intermission. Uh-huh. During the intermission, you couldn't get near the place to get an ice cream. So I said, "Well, how about an ice cream place that I knew?" Okay, they'll go to that ice cream place. Now, Amy, her father being a big shot, he was administrator general. That's a high post.
Oh, really?
He could drive a car.
Oh.
Nobody else could get gasoline, but she and her brother could get all the gasoline they want. Their parents were in America, I believe. Yeah, in America. And so the brother and Amy could drive when the rest of the country couldn't drive.
I see.
So they drove. Mary and Amy now drove to this ice cream place. And it was an outside place and lights and sort of nice vines going up. And you sit there, very nice place. So we have an ice cream, and then I asked her if she would go out with me. She says she cannot go out with me unless I go and meet her family first, and then if she gets permission from the family, she'll go out with me. So that was a hurdle.
And I guess you passed.
No, I didn't pass. I went... I don't know what you mean by pass, but I did go to her dinner. She asked me to have dinner at her home.
Uh-huh.
So, as I told you, there's no way transportation except for bicycle. So I take my bicycle. I ride about 2 or 3 miles uphill to her place. I come to her place. The garage door is wide open, no car in it. The front gate where the car is supposed to go through, wide open. The personnel door doesn't work properly. I go inside. In the driveway, I look on the veranda. All the windows, 84 of them, are broken on the doors. I hear some women in the back talking loudly. I say, "Am I in the right place? The girl seems to be, speaks like a lady, and she obviously has a very responsible job as..." She is acting curator when the curator is out, and she runs the biology department and the library. So I said, "Well, I come this far, I might as well go and see what's going on." I go on the veranda. It's a beautifully polished red and white tile veranda, but all the doors to the outside, every window is broken. I couldn't figure that one out. Amy comes in a beautiful evening dress, all the way down to the toes almost, and she asked me, "Won't you come in?" So I come in. There's stone-faced Aunt Beulah. and two servants laying a table, beautifully laid table, and two kids run outside and climb on a tree and start singing at the top of their voices. So one, the girl is 11 and the boy is 10. No, not that old. Wait a minute. Amy was, well, was, I was 21. Amy was, no, it was after the war, right? Amy was about 20 and I was 26. Yeah, around that. Anyway, the kids wouldn't obey, wouldn't come down to eat. And Amy asked me to sit down. This Aunt Beulah has a stone face. I'm a war, you know. It's war, it's going on. And finally, the kids come in. Kathleen, the little one, she sits more or less opposite to me. And Alan, her brother, who's a year younger, shows off his physical prowess by swinging his leg over the chair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he doesn't make it. So the chair hits the table very hard, and on the table was a carafe of ice water, and that ice water was coming in my direction. When I was a goalkeeper, I was very quick in reaction. I got up in time for the ice water to wash over the tablecloth and floor and so on. The two servants come running in and clean up the mess. I can see Amy, she looked so embarrassed, it's unbelievable. Finally, the little girl says to me, my sister is not going out with any foreigner, especially not a German.
Aha, there'd been family conversation.
So I said, who you call a foreigner? You, of course. I said, well, when were you born? I was born in 1934. I said, well, I was in Jamaica since 1933, so I'm in Jamaica longer than you. So who you call a foreigner now?
Uh-huh.
So I shut her up.
Well, what did you find out about the broken windows?
So I finally get alone with Amy a little bit, sit on the veranda, and she says, you know those kids, they knew a gentleman was coming to see me. They took a ball and played ball on the veranda and broke every window. I felt really sorry, and it was really not a nice evening. She was embarrassed to no end, and I was felt very unwanted by the family. That Aunt Beulah never spoke a word to me.
Were Amy's parents there?
So I said goodnight very nicely and politely, get on my bicycle, rode home. I said, that's it, never, never again. The family doesn't want me. I'm not going to be trouble for her.
Yeah.
No way am I going back there. So the next morning as I got up, I said to myself, you know, no girl ever went to all that trouble to make me a nice dinner and be so nice to me. Most of the girls don't want to be seen with a German.
Yeah.
So I really owe her. So I rode my bicycle and took a tape measure along and measured the size of the windows. I rode to a hardware store and cut the size windows, 84 of them. I actually was 90. I took 90 window panes, made 90 window panes. They're little, I can show you those. And a pot of putty. I rode up back there. I cleaned the frames out with a putty knife and put in 84 windows, not a soul disturbing me. They were all in the back. And Amy, of course, was at work. The two children were at school.
So nobody even knew you were doing...
And Aunt Beulah were in the back, so they never knew I was there. So I finished the job. I rode home. I said, well, now we're quits. Don't, at least I don't feel obligated anymore.
Yeah.
So I hardly reach home when the phone rings. Arnold, did you fix all those windows? I didn't know where to turn to fix those windows. I said, yes, I fixed them. He says, oh, that was awfully nice of you. I hope we see each other again. I said, yeah, how about tonight? He says, yes, do come over.
Ah, magic windows. Well, how much was that? Was that a lot to pay? Was that very costly?
No, it wasn't very costly. It was just
time consuming.
I more or less lost the day at work.
Sure did.
I had my own shop, you see.
Sure. And you'd rather do that than fix the windows.
Anyway, from then on, I was sort of Mr. Fix-It at that house.
Well, let me ask you, because part of my interest in doing this was to say, how did you and Amy find your way to Gainesville, Florida?
Well, my daughter had a degree in nutritional chemistry. In other words, what food would do to your brain.
Mm-hmm.
From Vassar University. And she got a scholarship from UF for another course in nutrition. I forgot what it was. Also starting with a master's degree course.
Uh-huh.
And she got her master's degree here. And while she was studying here, we were in New Jersey, and people kept phoning me to do one more job, either in machine design or in neon. And I love to work with glass.
Yeah.
So I always did one more job in neon.
Yeah.
But actually I worked 7 days a week sometimes. Anywhere between 5 and 7 days a week. So the doctor had told me that if I keep it up, I'll go blind. My eyes were giving out.
Uh-huh.
And this guy phoned me to do one more job. Amy picked up the other phone. And I said, yes, I'll be right over. Amy says, no, you won't. We are going to Florida.
What year was that?
Well, we finally moved to Florida in 1994.
Uh-huh.
In August. We bought the house many months earlier, but we wanted to sell our house and be in Old Bridge, New Jersey, until the house was sold. Well, finally, we decided to just leave it to a realtor and come here and move in.
Was it this house?
This house.
Uh-huh.